This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald. Here's a segment from our show, Kelly and Company, that airs weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio.
Isn't it convenient that we have a round table?
Well, it's actually oval. Just saying. Yeah,
the blind guy feels it now, goes, I guess it is oval.
Kind of oval.
Well, on Thursdays, we get a chance to talk with our guest. We invite somebody in to visit, and we kick around some items, usually some articles. Sometimes we take a specific theme, as we are with this whole week with Climate Action, as we move towards Saturday in our Youth Climate Action Day. Lawrence Gunther, he also was a great resource as he introduced us to Matthew, who we had on the show on Tuesday. First of all, Lawrence, let me welcome you to the program, joining Rumi and I today. Nice to have you back on here.
Well, it's nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
Lawrence, of course, the host of the Outdoors podcast, that Outdoors with Lawrence Gunther podcast, right here on AMI in our podcast stable. Lawrence, there's a lot. When I said to you, we're doing this Climate Action Week, buddy, what could we get into roundtable conversations about? And there was a fair bit that we kind of touched on that I know you'll be taking the floor with us, and Rumi and I asking you some follow-up stuff that dawns on us as we focus on climate action and kind of try to get a handle on some of the more recent announcements the federal government has made. Do you want to start anywhere in particular, or can we start right off the bat with our international commitment to protect 30% of Canada's three oceans and 30% of our land? Should we start there, or is there anything else you want to start with first?
Yeah, let's start there, because this is quite large, right? This 30 by 30 commitment was made almost like 10 years ago, and we're well on the way. We're going to get to 25% by 2025. So if nothing changes, we should be able to get to 30% by, 2030. What it means is, in terms of biodiversity and the loss of biodiversity, there's reports, very credible reports, saying that there's a million species at risk of being, extinct right now around the world. So that's biodiversity. When you lose a million species, that's huge, right? And then you think about, just maintaining our green space, our wetlands, all that carbon storing, capturing, nature. Mm-hmm. And then there's all that nature that we need for resilience in terms of the all these storms and fires and droughts. So we have to be more careful than ever to make sure we hang on to what we have, because we can see, just like this summer, so much burnt and drought. And
how do you replenish, right? Is where you start saying, it's one thing to have the disaster. It's one thing to figure out, oh boy, we're warming up too much, but then we still need, this has got to be replaced. We've got to allow the world to be able to heal.
Yeah. And it's healing. It's realizing that this environment, nature, has a value, and how do we value that? I mean, before we said, it's just nature. It's just there. If we can cut down a tree, that's a value. If we can pull some oil out of the ground or some natural gas, that's got value. If we can dig up some coal or some diamonds or gold, that's a value. Otherwise, it's just nature. It's just rocks and trees and water and swamp and things like that and birds and animals. But you know what? We realize more and more that all this nature has a value, because it's keeping our planet green. It's keeping our climate under control. It's keeping greenhouse gases down. Those are all services, my friend. They're all services. The environment should be charging us for that sort of stuff.
Exactly, because that's what makes us be able to support, to be able to do, to function. Rumi brought up earlier, and I'll bring her in on this here. Rumi, you mentioned earlier something interesting that I thought, when we talked about the beluga whales and the plastics and so much that we don't see, we don't know. We see here fresh water as one of the, 30% of our fresh water. We think of our lakes and we think of our drinking water. The oceans kind of are that thing a little further away, some of these woodlands and stuff like that, but a lot of it for you and I know Lawrence is dealing with, hey folks, I'm trying to draw some attention to this. For you, Rumi, what would you feel your area of least knowledge of where we're doing our damage. Like Lawrence said about the species, for example, you know, I think about, yeah, we lose species every day of trees, creatures. We just have no idea.
Yeah, exactly. And Lawrence, and I really thought of you when I was making that comment earlier as well. You know, I'm so connected to my dog. I know he's not supposed to ingest plastic, but what is happening with the whales out there, right? And the fish in our seas. And honestly, it's because we have such disconnect to nature. We might have started going on more walks and hearing how quiet it feels without all the traffic on the streets and whatever else during the pandemic. But before this, you know, how many years does it take, especially for us city dwellers, to realize like we're not taking care of our green spaces and we're not taking care of our waters and we're not even going out to appreciate what these are, what these elements of nature are. And it's because we feel so disconnected. And then later on, when we talked about the Museum of Climate Change in US, I realized it's not even just nature that we're disconnected to. We're totally disconnected to each other. You know, we're barely having the conversations we need to have on with each other on what these changes need to be and what our everyday, you know, expectations for each other could be like, or the kinds of things that we can take on ourselves. Everybody has ideas potentially, or at least, you know, reasons for not having the hope or the encouragement for what we can do for climate change. But I don't even feel that we're talking about it enough.
We started it during the election, and you know what? It's like was the number one issue for so many Canadians. And then, you know, before the election, we had some parties that were in favor, some parties that were sort of on the fence, some parties that said, "Oh, there's no climate change." And I think, you know, people say, "Well, we got nothing out of this election." I think at the end of the election, this federal election we just had in September, we now have a situation where all the major political parties agree that there's climate change, agree that we have to do something about it. It's just a matter of how much do we do and when do we do it
and
how much
quick,
are we going to spend.
Right. Yeah.
And how quick, because so this moved the flags for sure for us, you know, that it's not, we're not talking about yes or no. We're talking about yes and yes and how much yes. And you know what? Like, I know we can recycle and I know we can pick up and I know we can monitor how much we take vehicles and, you know, we walk more and take less cars and ask for less rides and so on. And we can take all these actions as individuals and they're all good. But in the end, it really comes down to the big ones, right? The big ones are the contributors, like the big, you know, I'm thinking Alberta with the oil sands projects there. And you know, what's going on there and forestry, you know, where we have huge swaths of clear cutting happening and mining operations that are just unsustainable. And, you know, we need to get a handle on these big operations that involve so many jobs and so much money and so much tax revenue and economic activity.
Yeah.
Even things like farming, right? And building cars, like, you know, we have commitments now to build electric cars, but are they coming soon enough?
Right. And the gas cars are not just going to disappear.
No, they won't.
No,
but we need to make these shifts and we need to fuel these shifts. You know, like the U.S. government was saying, hey, we're going to put windmills all the way around the United States coastlines, right? And that was, they were talking about that. Denmark produces all their electrical energy through windmills. And I was just listening to something the other day. They're laying down huge cables throughout Europe and between Europe and other countries. So say there's no wind in Denmark today and the windmills are all sitting there stagnant, but you've got a giant cable going off to another part of Europe or maybe the Mediterranean where they have a lot of sun and solar panels set up and creating all sorts of surplus energy. So yeah, they'll tap into that solar energy for that day or vice versa, right? You know, windy day, those windmills.
So where production is, yes.
Yeah. Sharing it around, right? We need to do this. We need to move in these directions, like at a big level, big level. Yeah.
I want to ask you about the 30 by 30 by 30 there, let me say it right. The federal government in negotiations with Indigenous nations to establish, you know, the protected and conserved areas. Now, they may be part of the same areas that are established under the 30 by 30 commitment or other land areas. Can we talk a little bit about these overlapping initiatives?
It's exciting. And, you know, when you Google this, like I've been listening to a lot of webinars lately from the David Suzuki Foundation and other groups, you know, where they're bringing Indigenous people in or negotiating these things with their provincial governments, federal governments, local governments, and saying, hey, this is our land. You know, we've always had this land. We'd like to have more control over how the land is used and exploited and who gets to use it. And so and the government, I think the federal government is realizing, hey, you know what, if we're going to designate 30% of our land and our fresh water and our oceans, maybe we need some help with figuring out how this is going to look. And maybe we can also leverage this into settling some of these 70 ongoing land claims that haven't been settled yet, or these other claims or offers of support by Indigenous communities to say, hey, these are traditional lands, they're unceded, and we'd like to have some control over them, you know, land claims aside. So this is opening up a whole opportunity to enter into these discussions with First Nations communities across Canada to get them to bring their local traditional knowledge, their to hire them and engage them and fund them in the protection aspect, the guardian role, you know, which we would call conservation officers or environmental officers, things like that, giving them the training and the skills and the resources to do that kind of work. So it's a... And that advances, you know, it advances self-governance, advances self-sufficiency, because it's jobs, and now they have some direct control over the jobs and the economic development in those areas. You know, they're not going to just slam the door and say everyone out. You know, this is all nature preserve. That's not going to happen, right? And don't fool yourself into thinking just because they're First Nations people, that's where they want to go in back in time. That's not the case at all. What they want is they want sustainable economic development. And they want to make sure everything they do is looking seven generations down the road so that it's still in healthy nature seven generations later. And that everything that happens respects their values and their principles. So, so we're starting to lean on Indigenous communities to help set up these 30 by 30 protected areas, and they're called Indigenous protected and conserved areas. So protected and conserved is interesting, right? Because conserved is one thing. It's like these are the rules, these are the policies. Protected is the guardianship. It's the feet on the ground role.
For Rumi and I, with the team here, and when we know that we just started our Reconciliation Day, and so many thoughts are, who's listening? And Rami, I don't know how you feel about this, especially as you've heard these politicians say what they've said. I always get a doubting Thomas of, are we going to be in such a hurry? Mm-hmm. Are we really going to listen to the people? Rum, have you felt that kind of thing, especially when we look at the smaller communities in the north that this is supposed to protect and we're supposed to talk to?
Yeah, again, going back to the connections that we're clearly having to build, right? Like, we can't just sit in our own homes and have these private conversations about climate change. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Is it really happening? But we need to actually have these connectivity with the different communities that are out there. And National Truth and Reconciliation Day, as we heard over and over again, is just the start, right? Like, it was just the beginning of building these partnerships and hearing what communities have to say. And honestly, I feel like we need to turn to our Indigenous communities because they know what's up. They know what preserving land and water actually means. You know, it's built in what they follow, the lifestyles and culture.
And need for them in a different way than us, Lawrence. And again, exactly. We all need water, but so many people in Indigenous communities still very much the land takes care of them. And I think we're removed enough that we stop and don't realize how much it takes care of us. What do you see in the future for this and engaging them?
You know, if you look at a lot of First Nations communities that are more remotely located, you know, they are suffering. There's poverty, unemployment, you know, substance abuse, all sorts of abuse and situations going on because there's just nothing for them, right? There's nothing for them. So, you know, this could open up opportunities for them to have control and bring in the needed resources, to bring in the needed development and economic generators that they're going to want. So, yeah, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to look the same as it is now. You know, it's going to be maybe more vigorous economic activity spread outside the cities, because right now we have 81% of the population living in cities. And if you look at the towns outside the cities, you know, young people leave those cities, they come to those towns, they come to the city, go to college, university, get a job. They don't go back. So we're experiencing a hollowing out of our rural communities across Canada. You know, instead of like 12 little farms around a small town, you have one giant farm, and the owner lives somewhere in the city, and he's driving his massive tractors with satellites and GPS, right? So, you know, there's a lot of things that are happening that are moving people off the country. We call it progress. Yeah, for sure. It's changing, but it's not. What we need is to get more economic opportunities into those rural areas, remote areas, northern areas, where a lot of these First Nations communities are, so that they don't have to abandon their land. I think about Newfoundland and when they had to shut down all those coastal communities because, you know, they didn't have roads. The only place to get to them was by float plane or boat. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have schools. They didn't have hospitals. They didn't have doctors. They didn't have all those things that you need to have a viable community. And so the government just said, in Newfoundland just said, okay, we're not going to, you got to leave. You got to come to the city and we're going to give you all $100,000 to just walk away from your home. You know, that's not a viable solution for First Nations communities. That's called assimilation.
Yep.
And we don't want to, you know, that's not an option, right? It's not an option. So we have to figure out ways to bring economic opportunity to those people. And the best way to do it is to work with them and to give them control over how it happens. So it's going to change. Is it going to all fit with climate change? Is it all going to fit with the conservation principles and protection principles that some environmental groups want to promote? Yep. No, it won't. It's going to be a mix.
Lawrence, as usual, thank you very much for bringing some thought, some knowledge and information to the listeners here on Kelly & Company. Pal, thanks for joining us on the roundtable.
Oh, my pleasure, you guys. Anytime.
Lawrence Gunther, host of Outdoors with Lawrence Gunther. You can follow the podcast and listen in right here from AMI. We'll take a break, tell you what's coming up on Now with Dave Brown tomorrow, and a peek at Kelly & Company. We'll do that in just 2 minutes. You've been listening to Kelly & Company. If you're hooked, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform. And be sure to leave us a rating and review. Or you can listen live from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.